Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
This episode is sponsored by Manolatus Nelson Murphy Advertising and Public Relations. Stay tuned at the end of our show for an interview with M&M's new vice president, Tanya Castaneda. Tanya sat down with our producer, Nate John, to talk about her career and her area of specialization, public affairs, public relations. So stick around.
I was listening to one of my podcasts yesterday, and I always think that they do a similar intro the same way every time. And I always laugh to myself how flawless it is every time and how easy it seems. And they finally mentioned, they were like, yeah, we record like 7 or 8 of those every episode. It's really hard to say that simple thing.
Oh, thank
that's
you.
That's good.
That's nice. I appreciate that.
No problem.
All right. 3, 2. Thanks for joining us on the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the editor-in-chief at Voice. I'm joined by my friend and assistant editor, Andrew Keats.
Hello.
And managing editor and also friend, Sarah Libby.
What's up?
How are you guys?
Good.
Seems like it.
We last week did the live show, had a lot of fun at the live show, and met a lot of folks, and thanks for coming out to everybody who did at the Whistle Stop. If you didn't, hope you enjoyed the show. But there's some news. We rounded that up in the politics report. And then I took off for the weekend, took a few days off, and went to Idlewild. Hadn't been there before. And of course, being the big deal that I am, I went and met the mayor of Idlewild.
Yes. So when I saw this on your social media, I thought like, oh, that's cute. It's kind of weird that he's bragging about it. You've since informed me that there's quite a development.
Yeah, the mayor is a dog.
Yeah. That really is a game changer.
Mayor Max. It was fun. We called and figured out where he was going to be and making his appearance. We had our own dog, Coco, with us, and shows up.
Did Coco sniff the mayor's butt?
So the mayor stayed in the back of the pickup, so Coco couldn't actually get butt sniffing.
It's like a Pope Mobile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have to give like significant donations to get butt sniffing.
Right, I would imagine.
This is political system that seems familiar in a lot of ways.
So, but there was one moment I have to describe this. Like my kids, we did a lot of hiking. We saw a lot of things, had a lot of fun together, family fun, roasted marshmallows. And my kids' highlight is this, and it's precisely because of this moment where the lady with Mayor Max says, is there any kids there? And my daughter and son raise their hands, and she goes, and out of nowhere, she pulls out little stuffed versions of Mayor Max and Hannah's at my daughter, and my daughter's face was just this bright bliss. It was bliss. It was pure bliss to see that being handed to her, and she jumped up and down and clutched it, and I was like, Mayor Max, good job.
Good job.
You know what you're doing.
Got my vote.
A strong mayor?
Yes, he's say? The executive. Yes.
Yeah. Wow, good for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly like a thing. I guess you met him too, so it's not just because I'm a big deal.
No, yeah, I think everyone who goes to Idlewild gets to meet Mayor Max.
Yeah,
but kudos to their marketing department. It's a good small town tourism bureau that comes up with something like this.
See, he's got it. He's a big golden retriever. He's getting a little chubby because of all the ice cream that he gets.
Oh,
yeah. Well, he hangs outside of a candy store, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And he's got a little tie.
Yeah.
So anyway, obviously everywhere I go, the politicians want to meet and get some ideas.
Yeah.
And Mayor Max got some.
Before the show, you said that you would say that, and then you asked us to dunk on you. And I pointed out that it was a request much like suggesting that we would like nickname you Spike or something along those lines.
Thanks, Andy.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. All right. We got a good show. We're going to talk some more about your investigation into Kevin Beiser and that issue. We've got an update on vaccine medical exemptions and our hero and goat of the week. And we are also going to talk about baseball. We, Sarah, Andy and I are going to try to convince you that baseball is cool. Basically, we're going to do a San Diego Padres explained about a few minutes.
So what I'm really worried about...
Living in my nightmare. You guys going to tell me how great jazz is after this?
I was just going to say that my big concern here is that what is going to happen is that I'll stop liking baseball. Just
this
Sarah,
is my plan, actually.
Sarah will just be Sarah, and I'll walk away and be like, I guess I don't like baseball anymore. My whole life
years and
is
years
over.
Of studying this thing. So you're going to get Padres 101, Padres Explained. If you want to follow the season, it's opening day this week. Sarah has given us, we have moral license to mansplain. She's agreed to be mansplained
We're
to.
We're doing this,
so it's okay to mansplain when you're invited to, right?
I guess so.
Like I said, I'm very concerned that how this is going to go.
Okay, so let's talk about the news of the week. All right, last week, Andy broke the story of four men accusing San Diego Unified School District trustee, member of the Board of Education, Kevin Beiser, of sexual assault and harassment. Since then, the San Diego Democratic Party and a bevy of local elected officials have called on Beiser to resign. Okay, you had an update Tuesday night, Andy, that multiple activists and Democratic Party officials say they knew since at least December that one or more men were prepared to go public with the accusations against Beiser, and that he had meetings and other discussions to try to identify who they were before they went public. What more can you tell us on that?
Various people within the party, party activists, party officials, now party officials, knew about some degree of this. Different folks knew different level of detail. And as Beiser was aware of these accusations percolating around the party, he started huddling with people he presumed to be allies to plan how he would deal with it. That included, one person said he was talking about bringing in a lawyer, another person said he definitely already had a lawyer and that he was already discussing defamation suits against anyone who accused him of anything, and that he was speculating about names, and that he even had requested people to help him reach out to people and find out who might be saying things, and was kind of running his own investigation to figure out who it was and what they were going to say.
Now, after you published the investigation, I guess it was Monday at about, or Tuesday at about 5 p.m., right?
Yeah, last week, yeah.
We got a statement from Kevin Beiser. It was actually texted to my phone, and it said, one of the things it said was we deny all these things, but then another thing it said was that we were only informed of these accusations within the last 24 hours. And I mean, let's break down that statement for a second.
Yeah. So he said we were informed of these allegations less than 24 hours ago. If we were to be exceptionally generous and say that he was specifically talking about the details of these allegations, and that, you know, just because he was aware someone was going to say something, he was not necessarily aware of the details that they were going to inform. Perhaps that's the case. Actually, we'll get to that in a second. But it is clear from this reporting that he was aware that people were ready to come forward and that he had been prepared for it and planning for it for quite a while, since early January. And that he had actually heard about it back in December, back when different party officials had as well. So those people include Will Rodriguez Kennedy, who's now the chair of the party. He was not at that time, but he was already known to be running for it. An activist named Alan Acevedo. Will Rodriguez Kennedy and Alan Acevedo together were part of the group of people who accused Eric Bauman of different types of misconduct.
He's
back
the
in November.
Former chairman of the California Democratic Party.
And so they actually, you know, they explained to me that they had been talking to each other after the Bauman situation and said that, like they had there, where people had come together as a group and there had been this central organization so that they didn't all have to share that burden individually, that they would want to recreate that here. And so when Will started hearing from people, he directed them to
Eva Posner, who Eva Posner is the person who planned the first meeting where I learned the four stories from the four separate accusers. She had already been talking to two of them. And so when he heard there was another person, he sent John Doe to her. And so that was all happening behind the scenes. And then roughly around the same time period, Beiser started planning his response. Now, I would add to that that we sent him the details of the allegations more than 24 hours before he made that statement. But in the spirit of it, let's, you know, not set our clock to it.
So one of the things I think I wanted to ask you about or just talk about a little bit is just this. Let's just establish, what is the earliest we know for sure that Beiser knew and that other Democratic officials knew that this was, that there was a concern about these accusations? December?
No, even before December, because as my first story detailed, Jess Durfee, mm-hmm. who was one of the people who was invited to the Kevin Beiser's planning attempts to plan a response to this, Jess Durfee had approached one of the accusers as early as July of 2018 and said, "This rumor's going around. I wanted to hear it from you. Is this true?" And the person said, "It is not true." And he said, "Well, if that's the case, then you should tell Kevin that he has nothing to worry about." So we know that at the very least it was out there within those circles, and Kevin and Jess Durfee were aware of it as far back as July.
Yeah, it seems like there's a difference between when it comes to both party officials and activists and Kevin Beiser himself. Everybody was aware, it sounds like, that there were rumors that something bad had happened, and whether it involved one person or several people, no one was quite sure. The question, it seems like, is when specific party officials knew about specific accusations.
Right. And that seems to have come later. And I mean, Patrick McFarlane told Jess Durfee at that time that it was not true, and then texted Kevin, "I don't plan to say anything. You have nothing to worry about."
Yeah, there seems to be also this sort of effort at weaponization or scandalization of the facts that you lay out, as though there's some sort of like overt or covert conspiracy that is still being untold based on the facts that you've made over that are out there. So, for instance, that people within the Democratic Party organized this, sent the accusers to one place, and then organized the first interview that you got with that. That's all been made public. That's not a weird conspiracy to come up. That's what everybody acknowledges happened.
In the story.
And yet some people are twisting that as though like, ooh, Democratic Party knew about it, and then they, you know, planned and strategized how to get it out.
Yeah, well, there's this question about, I mean, people did know. So, for instance, Steve Padilla, Chula Vista councilman, he learned from Patrick McFarlane what had happened to him right after it took place in the spring of 2017. So he's known for a long time. But Patrick McFarlane told him, "I don't want you to tell anyone. This is between you and I." So, you know, what do you do if, I guess somebody could speculate about what you should do. But there's a lack of a willingness to engage about what happens when you're aware of things or you hear about things, but the person that they happened to is for one reason or another not willing to go forward yet. Yeah. And so also, Eva Posner told this to the reader. She told me as well, and this also appears in the first story. They were running, two of these people were running for office at the time, and so they didn't want to come forward in the midst of their own campaigns. And so, you know, one thing Kevin Beiser has said is this is all political. And I had a conversation with one person who said, "Well, it doesn't seem like it isn't political." And I think that's a fine thing to say, to the extent that Kevin Beiser is a politician. Three of these people ran for office themselves. All of them were involved in politics. They were interacting with each other within the political world. Their party activists, party consultants are up and down this thing. So yes, that inevitably there are politics involved with when this came out and for what reasons it didn't come out at the time. The question is whether there are nefarious political reasons for that, or whether there are understandable personal reasons that played out in the context of politics. Yeah. And I don't see people necessarily grappling with the contrast between those two things.
Right, and the accusation that it's only political would be in the sense that it would not have come out if it weren't for a political effort.
Yeah,
you know, if it weren't for some sort of struggle for power. But if he's a private citizen and wasn't a politician, then it wouldn't have come out in the same way, because that's not how that works. That's not, he's not a person in power. That's the whole point. Yeah. And he's literally in power over schools, over teachers, over all kinds of situations. And so it's not odd to me that this is a route that it would come out.
Right. And I mean, you know, what Patrick McFarlane was running for office and didn't want to say something during the midst of his campaign. I think you could have a reasonable disagreement with him that he should have, maybe, if you want to say that to him, but to say that he did that while looking after his own campaign is not the same as saying he did this to Kevin specifically for his own political motivations.
I also think that there's room for scrutiny, though, in terms of, I don't think anybody thinks, you know, these men should have been forced to tell their story before they were ready, or that anyone should have, you know, outed them as accusers when it wasn't their story to tell. However, I mean, Kevin Beiser did run for office and win election in November 2018. And if people knew, even if they didn't know specific accusations, that there was cause for concern, I think, you know, it's right to turn some scrutiny on the party as far as how much support they gave him, whether they investigated those concerns thoroughly, things like that.
And it brings the other point, which is that we're talking a lot about process and, you know, these ideas and how it came out and such. We shouldn't forget that the real story is that four men have accused a sitting San Diego Unified School trustees member from some very horrific things, and that's the story. And there hasn't been a single thing said or done to refute what they have said.
Right.
In fact, quite the opposite. There's just been a lot of corroborating, you know, discussion. And so there's no response yet. And Beiser promised a vigorous, you know, defense and response, and it hasn't come.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that has been floating around out there is some sort of scrutiny on the claims made by John Doe. But what is interesting about those is they're scrutinizing the story he lays out in his lawsuit.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not something he's hidden and that they've uncovered inconvenient facts. They're just looking explicitly at what he says happened and saying, that doesn't make sense to me, which I guess they're free to do. Another way to look at it is, it seems like they had a very complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's not something that is very easy to litigate.
All right, well, good work on that. Thank you for the follow-up. Next up, we do have another update from a story we broke last week. There was a South Park doctor, that's literally the name of her practice, who was responsible for about a third of the medical exemptions that had been given out to parents and of students in San Diego Unified School District. You can't attend school without vaccinations, and she had given one-third of the exemptions to that requirement that have been issued in the San Diego Unified School District. And this week we got an update about that particular issue where we actually got a shout out. Okay, this is Senator Richard Pan, who represents Sacramento. He's proposing a new law.
Unfortunately, a few unethical physicians advertised medical exemptions for cash. These physicians were often not even trained in pediatrics or family medicine and were not providing ongoing care for these children. Instead, they were monetizing their medical license by selling these exemptions. Now, I am grateful for the media for actually investigating and making the public aware of how these unethical physicians were putting our children and the public in danger for a quick buck. Some schools had actually reported medical exemption rates over 20%, when a vaccination rate above 94% was necessary for community immunity. An investigation in San Diego Unified School District showed that the percentage of kindergartners receiving a permanent medical exemption rose sixfold in only 3 years, with one physician writing nearly a third of the exemptions. And many of these exemptions were not based on professional standard of care.
So that's an interesting update. Now, to be clear, the South Park doctor we reported on, we don't know that she was doing some of these things that he listed there about, you know, monetizing her medical license and all that. But that's...
Well, she did advertise that, you know, for $180 a visit, she would consider medical exemptions.
Right, right, right. So what's being proposed here?
Yeah, so Richard Pan is the same lawmaker who wrote the original law in 2015 that did away with most personal belief exemptions, and that left only these medical exemptions on the table if you want a child to go to daycare or public school or even private school and not have a vaccination. He's also a pediatrician. So his new law would crack down on this second kind of exemption, the medical exemption, and it would actually take the power to grant these exemptions out of the hands of doctors altogether. So you would have to go to the state's Department of Public Health in order to get an exemption. And the second thing it would do is create a database of the vaccine exemptions and, you know, who gave them out and what they were for. And it would also allow the department to revoke exemptions based on whether they were found to be fraudulent for some reason, or if they believe that they were given out for a reason that didn't correspond with CDC guidelines, which was something we also, you know, delved into in our story, which was this South Park doctor, for example, gave out a lot of exemptions based on a family history of autoimmune disease. And several of the experts we talked to and the CDC said that's really not a valid reason for an exemption.
So I'm sure this generated some real thoughtful and good discussion on Facebook.
Yeah, already.
Yeah. But along with him is Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez again.
Yeah, so she also was involved in the 2015 fight, which was the most bananas fight I've witnessed in state government,
wow,
by the way. So she is signed on as a co-author. She's all in. Talked to her. She said she's ready for another round with vaccine opponents.
Rob Schneider and Dharma from Dharma and Greg?
Yeah, Jenna Elfman.
Jenna Elfman, that's right.
Get ready.
All right, after the break, we are going to talk about pension reform and more of the development of that. But first, our hero of the week.
This goes to MTS, the Metropolitan Transit System. Andrew Bowen over at KPBS had a good story this week about a deal that MTS is coming close to striking with a developer at the Palm Avenue Transit Station. They would build 150 homes for low-income people and 100 homes reserved for people of middle income right at that area that is currently just a parking lot, basically. They also have deals in place. We're moving towards completion in East Village and Grantville. And this is kind of the culmination of Circulate San Diego produced a report a couple years ago arguing for an MTS making a more proactive push to develop their own property. It always seemed like a bit of low-hanging fruit in this world as we're looking for as much new housing as we can, especially near transit. And after adopting a new policy last year, seems like it's already bearing some fruit.
Yeah, so we're watching. We see you. Thank you for doing that. Our goat of the week.
You lose. Good day, sir.
There's somebody out there pretending to be me, calling people who have some level of or are perceived as having some sort of involvement in this Bicer scandal, calling and asking them questions, saying that they're Andrew Keats from Voice of San Diego. It is very concerning. It is not a cool thing to do. It is threatening in many ways. And whoever's doing it is a bad person.
And we're doing this to tell you, if you're out there and you get a call from anybody at Voice of San Diego, feel free to call the office and double check. Feel free to scrutinize it in any way you want. We will not hold it against you.
Also, we're not going to be calling you from a blocked number, so that's one signal right there.
Right. Yes. And so anyway, feel free to double check, and we are going to be totally accommodating to that.
Our emails are all posted on the website. You know, if you get a suspicious call, say that you'll send them an email and send us an email at the listed address on the website.
All right. Thank you. On the other side of the break, we will try to convince Sarah that the Padres are awesome in our San Diego Padres Explained segment. And I also wanted to get into the pension news this week, that the city of San Diego has a pension scandal that it just cannot shake.
So I really am just passionate about building trust in the institutions that serve us, governments, nonprofits, businesses, and developments. I really am a believer in good government. I'm a believer in public participation. And so Manolatos Nelson Murphy, Inc. reached out to me with an
offer. Hey, Nate John here. That's the voice of Tanya Castaneda. In addition to trust and good governance, she loves artichokes and the color red. You'll hear more about her after this next half of the show on pensions and baseball, so stick with us to hear how she wants to build trust in San Diego institutions. And you can find out what public affairs, public relations, actually is, because I didn't know. That's coming up in a bit.
We are back. It wouldn't be a Voices of San Diego podcast if I didn't talk about pensions. On Monday, the California Court of Appeal declined to invalidate Proposition B, the city's legally dubious 2012 pension reform measure, but it confirmed employees must be compensated for lost benefits during that time. So anybody hired after 2012. The state Supreme Court last summer had ruled that former San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders illegally pushed Prop B onto the ballots. He was the city's labor chief negotiator. He was the city's chief executive. And so, you know, he should have maybe met with them first, was the argument, before he pushed an alternative pension plan reform on the ballot. But courts are weird places, as our Ry Rivard wrote this week. So a measure that illegally became part of the city charter now remains part of the city charter until a court decides that not only did it get there illegally, but that it remains there illegally. And those are two separate legal questions. So I'm going to take the challenge this week to see if we can break down everything that's happening and why it matters, why it doesn't. Because it seems like it may not in many ways that matter, but it may in other ways.
Yes.
So should we start?
We should start.
Okay, so here's the deal. The 2012 measure took away pensions for future employees of the city of San Diego into perpetuity, right? Mm-hmm. Except for cops, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it says you are going to get, instead of a guaranteed amount of money when you retire, you're going to get whatever you save in this 401k style retirement plan. Got it?
Got it.
Now, a few years earlier, the city had reformed pensions with city employees and lowered them to a very low level of guaranteed pension into the future. That's an important fact to keep in mind here. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this reform happens, and then the unions make the argument that we just described, that the mayor shouldn't have allowed this, shouldn't have pushed this on the ballot, because he was one of the people named and took credit for putting it on the ballot. And he shouldn't have done that if he had not participated, which he had not, in negotiations with the unions first. It's called Meet and Confer. The Miles Milius Brown Act says that if you're going to try to push a change to people's benefits, if they work in public service, you have to meet with them first. Meet and confer. And so the union said that, led by Ann Smith, the labor leader or lawyer for the Municipal Employees Association, she made the argument that we might have made a deal. We might have been able to come to some agreement
to put something on the ballot.
Or to some other reform that satisfied your goals.
Right.
And even if they didn't, it still would have counted, right?
Yes.
You don't have to come to an agreement.
Exactly.
You just have to meet.
You just have to meet. And you can declare an impasse at that, and then you can do whatever you want. Right. Right? And so they went and they put it on the ballot. And she said, look, you didn't do that. And so this carries all the way out to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court of California says, she's right. You should have met with the union, and therefore this was illegal. Mm-hmm. Now, what that actually means, we aren't sure. So then it goes back down to the lower court, and they say, what should we do about this? And what we learned this week is that the lower court said, well, you should do what the first group that heard this case said, which is the Public Employees
Relations Board.
Thank you. That they
said,
Perb.
Thanks.
Can we get a drop of that? Cut that out.
The PERB said you should, the employees and the city should meet and come up with a solution to this.
Sorry.
Proud of that, aren't you?
Good pension content.
And the argument was they should be made whole. And the Court of Appeal, just this week, what we learned is they said, yes, that should happen. They should be made whole. But the other thing that the Court of Appeal did or did not do was it did not say, because that measure was put on the ballot illegally, the whole thing should be taken out of the city charter. So pensions are still not allowed for city employees who were hired after 2012, because it's in the city charter from this measure that they're not allowed.
Unless we start the MEA or somebody else starts a new lawsuit arguing that it should be stricken from the charter.
Yeah, it's not exactly a lawsuit. It's a effort called quo warranto, an argument that by what right is this the case, or by what right is that person in charge? And under this situation, it would be by what right is this law still in the city's books? And so it has to go through the California Attorney General and then courts, and then somebody could challenge it again all the way to the Supreme Court if they said, we want this taken out of city law.
But for now, that's on a separate track.
So that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
And so now the city unions and the city have to get together and decide what they should do about this. And here's the complicating factor. Is it would seem like they need to be made whole, is the argument, at 7% interest.
Yeah.
So if the decision was that they were $100 million, they got $100 million less than they would have if the pensions hadn't changed at all, well, then they would compound that times 7 each year to, you know, what, $150 million that they'd have to somehow disperse to people, right?
Yeah.
However, that's probably not the situation, because all of these 401k accounts have made a lot of money in the market. And in fact, at 9% or 9.6% or whatever that they're putting out and matching every year, they might have more in these 401k accounts than what you would have as a accrued pension benefit by this time.
Right. And even if it's not a negative number, maybe it's a small positive number, or it's just not that much money. The question is, and what is that argument here is, what is the value of the certainty of, as an employee, knowing that your pension is guaranteed versus the dollar value of having a riskier 401k that if you happen to retire at a time in a market downturn, you might be in trouble.
Right.
So I have a question. So the news that happened this week was that the court declined to invalidate Prop B and said, you know, this other, you have to make employees whole, but we're not going to gut it. So why was the reaction of both Barbara Bree and Todd Gloria, who are both running for mayor, that, well, it's clear that Prop B is going to be invalidated? I didn't understand the logic there, in that the reaction to the news to not invalidate it was that it's the writing's on the wall that it will be invalidated.
So the Court of Appeal was, remember, they were the ones that held that it was legal.
Right, yes.
And so the argument, I guess, is that it's so clear cut that it was illegally put on the ballot that all it is a matter of steps to go through this quo warranto process.
Okay, so they're relying on that separate track that they think is a sure thing.
Right, but either the city or the proponents of the law, it's pretty clear they could take that all the way to the California Supreme Court. And I'm not as confident as they might be that this is all a done deal. It seems like it's not only not done, could be many years, and it could just not turn out to want to. You know, there's a pretty good argument that the voters overwhelmingly supported this thing. And, you know, it just because this mayor wanted to take credit for putting it on the ballot doesn't mean it should be completely stripped out of law. So I don't know that they should be that confident that that would happen. On the other hand, you do have the high court now saying that it was illegally put on.
And in the meantime, the court has now said that meet and confer process that you did not do back when you were trying to put this on the ballot, now you need to go do it and figure out how you're going to reconcile the money that is needed to the make whole number.
And that point you made about the certainty, I think, is the key, in the sense that, you know, that is the value of a pension, right? We all have 401ks. Our generation has overwhelmingly 401ks, and it's a scary proposition. It's whatever you save. Maybe you save a bunch. Maybe you don't. It is one thing to know that, well, for the rest of my life, I will have this amount of money. And I think the question will be, how much is that worth? Yeah. How much is that certainty worth? And they'll probably make an argument that even though the accounts or the balances are this way, that certainty is worth blank amount of money.
You can attach a dollar figure to it somehow.
Right. And I think that finally, the last point I would want to make is this is a fundamental argument about employment, right? Because that's what the proponents of the measure said too, is that they don't want the certainty that the city would have to make up any differences that the market doesn't provide. And that's why they wanted to end pensions and guaranteed pensions. And so I think that represents this view of government, that government is just a service and that service should be delivered as efficiently and cheaply as possible, versus the argument from the labor unions and others that government is not only a service, an efficiently provided service, or should be an efficiently provided service, but it's also itself an employer, and it's also itself an investor in the community. And to that level, it should be held a very high standard of employment and benefits and other things that can help the whole competitive labor market. So we'll see how that gets resolved. All right. Tomorrow is opening day at Petco Park. Andrew Keats and I will be in attendance. I've never been more excited about any sports as a fan as I am about this. And I'm going to try to relate to the public why. And Sarah represents the public here. So welcome to Padres Explained 2019. Sarah.
Yes.
You can start. What is your current perception of the San Diego Padres?
That they're fine. They are an entity that exists in the same city as me. I want to stipulate a little bit. I am not somebody who's agnostic about sports.
No.
And I would also like to take this opportunity to once again remind everybody listening that I'm the only member of this podcast who was an NCAA Division I athlete.
No, I stipulated.
This would only make sense as a conversation topic to the extent that you like all sports and dislike baseball.
That's right.
Yes.
And it was also...
Well, not all sports.
You also just threw shade at Andy.
Because I'm a Division III athlete.
Yeah. And me, who was not an athlete.
Yeah, of any level. Of any significance.
Thanks.
No sweat.
All right, I'm going to take a sideways approach here.
Okay.
I'm not even going to really talk about baseball very much.
Oh, boy.
Because I've heard somebody explain what they love about baseball, and even as a baseball lover who loves those things, it just sounds absurd. Like the crack of the bat and the smell of the grass and all that stuff. Peanuts and Cracker Jacks and whatever. So I'm not going to go there. I'm going to make an argument to you as a Portlandia resident.
Okay.
Okay. San Diego has suffered some losses in the world of sport.
Sure.
We have nothing going for us.
That's right.
And in many ways, never have.
Yes.
But from what was a dismal position as perhaps the losingest sports city in America.
The Padres are the losingest baseball team in the last like 50 years.
Ever. Yeah, since they came into the league. So then you'd also, we've lost a team. The Chargers are gone.
Yes, that happened.
And so I think we have an opportunity to create this interesting relationship that sometimes one sport cities have with that one team. Much the way Portland has with the Portland Trailblazers.
Rip City.
And across the league in the NBA, fans know that Portland's kind of a special crowd because they just love that team, and there's like a sense of it's just like a love affair between the team and the city. And I think you can really only do that when you're like a one town team and you're just grateful that they're there. So it's like the Red Sox are Boston's crazy about the Red Sox, but that's not quite their relationship. They have a lot of expectations. There's entitlement. It's not a love affair necessarily. It's more of like sometimes it seems like they downright hate each other, the city and the team, right? And players get angry.
People in Boston are weird, man.
Yeah. So I think now what prevents that from happening right now is that they've been so bad. But I think that they are on the precipice of potentially being quite good. And if they were to become quite good in this city that has no other major sporting team, in a town that has a nice ballpark, in a neighborhood that's fun to go to, I think you could see 10 years from now, Padres baseball being the type of thing that's just kind of on the tip of everyone's tongues. When you're ordering a sandwich at the sandwich shop, people mention what happened in the game the day before. And it's just like this conversation topic that infiltrates the city in a way that can be quite nice for either a fanatic or a layperson who just has a passing interest in it. And that it'd be fun to get in on the ground floor of that. And I think that's where we are right now. I think this is the ground floor. That's my argument.
Interesting.
It's really, really well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so I will buttress that with this. So one of the great things about baseball is not just the story of the games and the wins and losses, but how the team comes together. And I mean, like, not some spiritual, like, how they come together. Literally the pieces that have to be put in place. And so baseball, unlike some of these other sports, has this extensive, each team has this extensive group of teams behind it in the lower minor leagues, right? And those minor league teams have a lot of different players, many of whom will never make the major leagues. But the Padres, over the last, what, 4 years? About 4 years, decided to really try to build the best group of players in those minor leagues as possible. And they made a lot of decisions and moves along that way. And several of the people that they put in there turned out to be extremely good. So good, in fact, that one of them is the best considered prospect in the entire league. So of all these hundreds of minor league teams, this guy is the first or second best prospect, right? It's hard to say which one exactly the best, but his name is Fernando Tatis, okay? And he is going to be the shortstop for the Padres. And just this week we learned, we never knew exactly when he would come up to be a Padre, but just this week we learned that Fernando Tatis is going to be starting for the Padres tomorrow at shortstop. And that's really weird for another reason, because he's usually they don't usually bring somebody up to play the full year like that. There's a labor rule that prohibits them from, or that makes it more advantageous for the owners to not do that. And so they've taken the extra effort to put him in there, and they're probably going to have to pay for that in some form. So if you add that to the fact that they brought in this international, like, well-known celebrity third baseman, Manny Machado, and a few of these other players, like, there's something really special coming together for this year. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's a good argument as well.
And so basically, we're at this interesting moment where all these young people we've watched for years are now coming up. And then there's this new superstar brought in. And they've made all these moves that seem like, okay, well, this is a special group of people that might be able to, over the next 4 or 5 years, really be dominant. Not just good, but dominant. But even if they're not dominant, we have a chance, like Andy said, to like really watch some exciting baseball. Now, what is an exciting baseball? Now, every baseball game has a moment of true excitement. Sometimes it's like 5 moments. And it's hard. It really is to sit there. It's hard to watch a 3-hour game. I understand that. And really, because especially when those exciting moments seem like intermittent, but when they are exciting, when it does happen, it's just a really special moment. And so how do you, it is a lot of commitment, but if you watch that whole story play out over the year, it's kind of fun to watch. It's reading a novel, kind of.
All right, Sarah. I'm very nervous about what you're going to say here.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us your thoughts on baseball.
All right. Well, I have some thoughts. I'm intrigued by your guys' approach because what it sounds like to me is that you're asking me to become something that is reviled among sports fans, which is a bandwagon jumper.
Well, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have always hated the idea that bandwagon jumpers are reviled in the first place.
Of course you do.
I think it's perfectly fine for people to have many things in their lives.
So that's a question is, you know, is it okay for me to make this move? Are you guys going to double cross me and say, you're not a real fan and you only just got into this?
That's part of what I want to do is because I do think that this is a moment still where they are the worst and have been the worst for quite some time.
And likely will be again for another year or two.
And so this is really a great window to say, I'm starting to follow this story.
All right. So, I mean, one thing you said that did resonate with me is being able to be part of this. So when I lived in D.C., I lived in D.C. right when RG3 started for the Redskins. And may not seem like it now, but there was a while where it was really exciting and really magical. And I got on the bus to go to work one day, and the guy sitting right at the front was talking to the bus driver about the game, and they were just like right on the precipice of like this really exciting thing happening to their town. It never ended up happening, but it was just like so special to watch. And I think about that moment still of just like these two guys talking about the game and did you see how RG3 played?
And that's why that's why I'm so excited about this team is because I've tried to follow these specific individuals for so long that like I've gotten into really rooting for them. So my favorite player on the Padres, for example, is Franmil Reyes. This is a guy who is a gigantic human being and he hits a lot of home runs. And he wasn't considered very good. In fact, they gave other teams the chance to take him, and they never did. And he got pulled up last year, and he did really well and hit a bunch of home runs. And now he's hit a bunch of home runs in spring training again. And he's just like this. Nobody thinks he's going to work out. And Andy just snickered because he probably won't work out.
No, that's not why I snickered.
But I think that he will. I think he's really fun to watch, and I'm just like rooting for him. You know what I mean? And there's like four or five of these other guys like that, like Fernando, and now they have Machado, who's not even my favorite player, but he's like he's a glorious third baseman. And so like each one of these guys, you just kind of like want to root for in many ways. Like Franmil, especially. I mean, he's from the Dominican Republic, underdog kind of feel, and I just think he has a chance, and it's fun to watch and root for. Why did you laugh? Tell me that.
My appeal would not be based on individuals.
Right. Well, I think that's one way. It's like there is the team versus the individual. I'm an individuals guy.
Yeah.
So the other thing I think is interesting about your guys' pitch is that like no one's tried to sell me on the idea that the game itself is all that interesting and fun, which has always been what I struggled with. Yeah. However, I am coming around very much to the idea that it's like more of a community and an experience. And I did go to one Padres game last season, and I had, you know, a young baby, and we sat in the grass and not in the stands, and like I couldn't have been more detached from the game. I'm juggling a baby and putting sunscreen on him, and yet it was the most fun I've had at a baseball game, the more detached I became. Like, I ate a Hodad's burger, and it was like a transcendent Hodad's burger. It was like far better than any Hodad's burger I've ever had. And I'm like I said, you know, like taking photos with the statue, and I'm doing all these things that don't involve watching the game. And it was like by far the best experience I've ever had going to a Padres game. So I'm on board for that. I also just feel like even though you guys didn't sell me on it by saying like, well, I grew up loving it, I do think that if you didn't grow up loving it, it's really hard. It's really hard to get into.
I think that's true, but I would add that to the extent that it becomes this thing that's in the fabric of the city, I think it starts to become a snowball rolling downhill. That like people are talking about it and you watch you check it for 10 minutes at a time to see what the score is. And then you pick up a person that you like a little bit. And so that's an entryway in. I think it can happen. But I think this, to me, the selling point is we're a one horse town now. You gotta pet the horse.
Yeah. Let me get a dig in at you guys a little bit. Okay. One good way to have sold me on this would maybe to have been to invite me to your little field trip in the middle of the day instead of leaving me to run the newsroom and not know about this, but, you know.
Fair point.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'll take that. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say not talking about the snacks at the stadium.
Oh, yeah, I'm sold on the snacks.
Yeah,
I'm there for
are.
It.
Yeah,
I'll go.
That was the part of the
buy
thing
me
I
the
could,
tickets.
I
Coming up on the People's Reporter Voice Engagement, editor Megan Wood sits down with Ryder Rivard, our reporter. They'll figure out what's going on with a decades-long project by the city. It seems to never end. It was the project to take overhead power lines and bury them in the ground.
Welcome to The People's Reporter, a Voice of San Diego feature that answers your questions. I'm Megan Wood. We're asking Voice reporter Rye Rivard for help this week because we recently got a question from Steve Ravlett about utilities going underground. Steve wrote to us and said, San Diego utility pole undergrounding started in 1970. Why, 48 years later, is the city of San Diego not even close to completing the job? So, Rye, let's take a step back. What is utility undergrounding?
We don't have to overthink it too much. It's taking overhead power lines and putting them underground. This effort started back in the 1970s, late 1960s, when Ronald Reagan was still governor.
And how are these projects funded?
There's a surcharge, as they call it. You can call it a fee, a tax, whatever you want, on your SDG&E bill. And you actually pay a little bit into your other utilities, too. AT&T, Cox, Spectrum, whatever cable and telecom provider you use. Some of that money gets diverted, although most of the money comes from SDG&E to bury lines.
So from your reporting this week, you said that there was about $180 million in the fund that the city has for these projects?
Yeah, surprisingly. So people have been complaining about for a long time that this process isn't happening fast enough. But the city's actually had trouble keeping pace with the amount of money coming in. This has been a problem that's cropped up over the decades and cropped up again recently, where there was, you know, millions and millions of dollars coming in to do what should have been lots and lots of projects, but for some reason or another, everybody couldn't get their act together to actually spend all the money. Now the city says, hey, we have a plan. We're going to spend money at about the rate it's coming in, and we're gonna do this a little bit faster than we've been doing it.
Okay, so knowing that, what's the current status?
So we've buried now a little over 400 miles of utility lines since, you know, the 1970s. And in the future, we're still going to have to bury over 1,200 miles of lines.
So when we got this question, Rye, you seemed really interested. After you did the reporting, was there anything that stood out to you?
I was pretty surprised that the issue wasn't always the amount of money, because usually when the city can't do something well, they say, well, it's, you know, we don't have the resources. Well, in this case, they've actually had the resources. They just haven't used it efficiently or expeditiously. There's, you know, some reasons for that, I think. You know, back in the 80s, there was back and forth with SDG&E about who owed who what. And then more recently, I think the issue has been environmental considerations. You know, this stuff has to get permitted. It has to clear the California Environmental Quality Act, which has been known to slow down projects. But it also requires a lot of coordination because you're going to be tearing up city streets. You're going to be burying not just SDG&E's lines, but telecommunications lines. So there's a lot of coordination that they point to. But I was surprised to find that it wasn't the money that was the main limiting factor.
All right. Thanks, Ray. Is there something about San Diego you want us to explain? Submit your question at vosd.org/ask. They could be featured in a future episode of this podcast. Again, that's vosd.org/ask.
All right, now we have a sponsored interview with Manolatos Nelson and Murphy Advertising and Public Relations. Voices Nate John sat down with M&M's VP of Public Relations, Tanya Castaneda.
I like red.
Favorite food?
Artichokes.
Really? Favorite movie?
Well, I guess it would have to be swimming pool.
Favorite place to work?
I love working where I'm working now.
Where's that?
M&M Inc. My name is Tanya Castaneda, and I'm Vice President of Public Relations at Manolatos Nelson Murphy, Inc.
And can you tell me a little bit more about yourself, like how you started working there? What were you doing before?
I've had a long career in the media and communications industry. So
okay.
I started out as a reporter years ago, worked for a bunch of different newspapers, and most recently worked for The Port as the public information officer. So I've been on both sides of the microphone and both sides of the notepad.
Mm-hmm.
And working at The Port as the public information officer, I really was able to delve into a lot of really important projects in San Diego and really hone my public relations craft. And so I really am just passionate about building trust in the institutions that serve us, governments, nonprofits, businesses, and
okay.
developments. I really am a believer in good government. I'm a believer in public participation. And so Manolatos Nelson Murphy, Inc. reached out to me with an opportunity. And so
mm-hmm.
I joined as Vice President of Public Relations. What I love about M&M is that it's one of the few firms in San Diego that really specializes in public affairs, public relations, and does it well.
What does that mean?
Public affairs is a unique specialty within the public relations field, and it's about the intersection of government, the media, and the public. And our clients are broad. We have a broad range of clients from government to development to nonprofit. And what's great about working at M&M is I'm working with some of the best people in the city. The network that I'm part of is incredible. We have a huge network on both sides of the political spectrum. We know so many of the people in town who are the decision makers and the leaders. And we're able to build these coalitions for our clients that really serve the public. They really help achieve the goals of our clients, such as one example might be getting a policy finalized. Another goal might be getting a development project built. Another goal might be raising the profile of an organization. We might want to help them become more appreciated and more understood by the people here.
Of those examples, is there one specifically that you can think of that you're especially proud of recently?
One of the things that we work with, in addition to our clients that I mentioned, we actually work with water agencies in 7 different states. So we have a very, very talented team of marketing and advertising professionals, and their specialties range from print collateral to digital and all different kinds of advertising. And I'm really proud of the work they do as well. And at times we work hand in hand, such as when we're doing a campaign.
Okay. And how long have you been at M&M now?
Been at M&M less than a month.
Okay. How is it in the first month? I've been at Voice of San Diego for 2 months now, so still kind of fresh. How is it in the first month?
I am just so impressed with the breadth of the work I get to do.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to coming to work each day because we get to serve some of these institutions that are iconic San Diego institutions.
Mm-hmm.
The clients we get to work with, we really provide them with excellent service. And I'm able to use my public affairs, public relations skills and experience and network and just have a diversity of experience, which is a lot of fun.
So maybe this is an awkward question, but this is about you. So what about you? Like, why are you so good at that? Like, what are the skills that you have that make you really effective at doing that for people or for organizations?
Well, I have to say that having been in San Diego for some time, probably about 13 years now,
mm-hmm.
I've developed a really great network and a lot of people who I can outreach to and really talk to them and talk about a project or talk about a client,
mm-hmm.
and they'll listen. And what's great about that is that I've gained a reputation in public relations because I'm accredited. Very few people in public relations become accredited in public relations.
What does that mean?
That's a worldwide credential recognized by dozens of public relations institutions. It is a signal that I adhere to the highest standards of the profession in terms of ethics,
mm-hmm.
progressive practices, and research-based decision-making. So being able to have those letters after my name really mean a lot. And
mm-hmm.
I've noticed that people really notice it and say, what does that mean? And I'm able to explain to them that when I'm offering public relations, it's not just me saying I'm good with people.
Yeah,
it's me knowing that I can look at the research. I can work on surveys. I've worked on many research efforts to inform how we're going to tell people about something.
Thank you so much for coming into the Voice of San Diego podcast studio.
Thank you.
If you want to get in touch with Tanya Castaneda and M&M Inc., you can find them at mnmadpr.com. Thanks again to our supporters at M&M for sponsoring this segment. And if you'd like to be featured here, you can write to us at development@voiceofsandiego.org.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast. Andy and I put out a newsletter every week. It's the Politics Report. Please subscribe to that if you want to keep up with us every week. And Sarah has her own newsletter you should check out. It's What We Learned This Week. Get those all at voiceofsandiego.org/newsletter. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief of Voice of San Diego. Andrew Keats is our Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby is Managing Editor. And this show is produced by Nate John. Our multimedia team is Megan Wood and Adriana Heldes. We'll talk to you next week.